I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome back to another edition of the Friday Golf Podcast. I am Andy Johnson, and I am back from Augusta. What a week. It's always a whirlwind. You get to Augusta, and we got in on Saturday night. And then before you know it, it's like Saturday night the next week, and you're looking at the final round right down the barrel. So what a win from Scottie Scheffler. Unbelievable performance and really quite the run that he's been on. It's just been amazing. So I had Shane Bacon. Shane was working, doing feature groups coverage for Masters. And it was fun to just kind of, we didn't talk a lot during the week. It's funny, you know, you got all your media friends there, and Shane's a good friend of mine, and you know, we see each other in passing, but we don't really talk about what's going on. So it was fun to chat with Shane and kind of unload each of our notebooks and stuff we wanted to get off our chest from this year's Masters. So before we get to Shane, today's podcast is brought to you by Bushnell. Bushnell has a new rangefinder. It's probably their best one yet. It is the Bushnell Pro X3, Bushnell Golf Pro X3 Plus. It's precision perfected, and this is next level performance because it now has wind. It is able to gauge the wind. It's going to tell you which speed, the speed and which direction is coming, along with the compensated distances. So it's going to factor in wind when you're shooting these numbers. I'd say one of the things you notice on tour is that when you look at a golf, a player's bag, almost all of them are always using Bushnell. It's trusted by 98.6% of PGA Tour players. It's, of course, got all the convenient things as rangefinders have evolved. I remember back to junior golf, my first Bushnell. I mean, it was huge. They're so much smaller now. It was like the wide one. You felt like you were looking through like a pair of binoculars on the first one. It was wide. It had one eye. But then now they've gotten so far. They obviously have the slope, and it's super easy to turn off and on. Same with the wind for tournament play. It grabs the pin super quick. It has the magnetic mount for people to ride in carts. And one of the big things, it is waterproof. So you don't have to worry about it if it's raining. So learn more about the new Pro X3 Plus with the wind gauge and all of that good stuff. And visit BushnellGolf.com. That's BushnellGolf.com. All right, I'm here with Shane Bacon. Shane was on the featured groups calls this week. Great job with those.
Thanks. You know, a lot of fun. Best week of the year.
I miss covering the Masters from home a little bit because I miss out on all like the Masters coverage because I'm kind of running around and I'm not really connected to it that much. Occasionally I'll sit inside for like half a day and I'll get to, watch and listen to it. But, you know, a lot of days I'm out. So I didn't hear a lot of your work. I heard a lot of your work was great though.
Oh, well, that's nice. Who told you that? Was that like friends of friends, or did I text you that it was great?
Three of your friends. It was an anonymous group chat.
Okay.
I didn't even have their numbers in my phone. They texted me. Shane was really great this week.
I pass, by the way, in case you're wondering, I always send your number to people. Anytime they're like, any course recommendations, I'm like, text Andy. He loves giving those out. So I'm always just passing your number to people.
Yeah, so that's who told me that you were
okay,
really great.
Perfect. Yeah. By the way, I consumed a lot of your podcasts this past week, and I've read a lot of your stuff, and I thought it was great. So that's actually a first person compliment right there.
Well, I will say there's like, I imagine with booths and working with people, you've worked with Colton Krasert a couple of years now running. I imagine you get better every year, right?
Oh, I mean, I think, you know, one of the main things about covering the Masters that's different than covering every other golf tournament is constantly reminding yourself that people are there to watch the golf course first, I'd say, is probably the most likely thing. And second is the golf tournament. And so we try as best we can to be minimalist in terms of the broadcast. And Kratz is the best at it, I'd say, in the group. I mean, Kratz is so good at interjecting when he's got an amazing point to be made. Colt and I can be a little sillier at times. I mean, as silly as you're going to be doing the Masters. But I feel like, yeah, I mean, I think this is our third or fourth year as a team doing it. And, you know, we kind of jump in those seats and rock and roll. But, it's the best week of the year. I mean, it really is. It's hard for me not to call the Open my favorite major championship just from my kind of roots across the pond, if you will, like growing up and caddy and things like that. But in terms of the most fun work week of the year, I think the Masters is easily number one.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's times where you can be really excited about a course on one of the other major championships because they rotate. Like this morning, the news that Kiowa got another PGA came out, and I was like, oh, I'm really excited because last time Kiowa was awesome. It was awesome to cover. It was an awesome tournament, like one of the most memorable majors of the last 10 years. And for my job, it was awesome to cover because like I was just at Kiowa Resort. I could go home. I'd ride a bike to the golf course and be back. And it was just like delightful. Yeah, it was delightful. So from that standpoint, you know, there are majors, and like last year's LACC, I was probably more excited for LACC last year than I was for the Masters, just because it was something that we don't get all the time. So I think that's kind of the push and pull, but especially this year with the weather. I mean, the golf course was just, we haven't seen it like that forever. I can't even recall going back when the last time we had really like four solid days of, you know, Thursday was a little soft because of the rain, but I mean, it dried out so quick with the wind.
I was thinking about this during the week last week, Andy, to your point about Augusta National. And I got a little out of Brendan's article about this as well, when he obviously got a chance to play it. And then he wrote a great piece. If you haven't read it, by the way, absolutely go check that out. It was awesome. But we all know, and when I say we, I mean golf fans, right? Diehard golf fans know Augusta National, and we learn more and more about it every single year. And when I'm calling the golf, I've never played Augusta National. I mean, I've never been between the ropes, right? I mean, I don't know what it's like to play the golf course and experience certain golf shots. But I know on every single hole where a guy's in trouble and if a guy's in a good spot. And I'd say that's pretty much across the board for anybody that's a golf fan that pays any amount of close attention to golf courses. I'd say people listening to this podcast probably understand, like, you see a tee shot with the tracer headed left on 8 and you know that guy's in trouble instantaneously. And I can't think of another golf course where you know right away if the person has a shot or doesn't. I was thinking 13, you'd see the second shots on 13, especially Friday and Saturday. You'd see those second shots creep over the back of 13 in that little swale. And you know, again, without having played the golf course and having no real course knowledge, you know how hard that golf shot is. And there's no other course on the planet like that where people truly know the goods and the bads of where players can hit shots. And I think that's what makes it so cool, is you almost have personal roots to it, even though almost everybody's never played it.
I think, you know, you hit on something here, just overarching. And just so people have the premise of the episode, we're just
we're deadbeats right now, just so you know. But yeah, go ahead.
The premise of the episode is we're just going to unload thoughts on the Masters. I was planning to write something, and I was writing it on my flight back. It was a late night flight back. And I was literally just like nodding off while I was writing it. At one point, my head hit the monitor of my computer because I had fallen asleep. And it just seems like this is better served for the podcast. So this, the idea is we're going to kind of unload some thoughts on that. But what you were saying about the course, like, I do want to point out pro golf, male pro golf especially, and I think women's pro golf is the same way. Unfortunately, they don't play. They play like a handful of courses where there are good and bad spots every week in, week out. You know, at TPC Sod Farm, TPC Minnesota, it really doesn't matter if they hit it on the right side or the left side of the fairway or the rough. Like, it doesn't matter. And I think that's one of the big problems with professional golf and with the PGA Tour's events. Like, they don't have a ton of an identity. They go back to the same place, but it's, you know, a lot of them just aren't great golf courses. And one of the reasons that this has happened is, like, pro golf has outgrown a lot of the great golf courses in America. And I think, you know, one of the things in the lead up of the Masters, I looked at the work on six. And I think Augusta National's in a really weird spot in terms of identity. I think Joel Beal hit on this in his article, great Golf Digest article last year. You know, what is Augusta National? Is it a great club? Is it a club? Or is it a tournament host? You know, does it run and host the biggest golf tournament in the world? And when you think about it through the lens of that, the golf course through the lens of that, I think they've been doing a lot of work, and they're probably the only ones with the means to do this, to keep their golf course relevant. And we saw it on full display this week. Like, I have a hard time believing that there was a better test of golf in the world than what we saw this week. Like, you just looked at the golf course, you watched the shots that you had to hit. And, like, as the tournament went on, the leaderboard just separated more and more. And it was very, very clear who the best players in the world were at that time, who had all the shots, who had all of this, the tools to play, because it was demanding everything of everyone. And you look at that leaderboard and you go through the top 10, and it's like every one of those guys in the top 10 is a stud. Those were the only guys that could handle this golf course this week. And sure, there were some great players who didn't have their best stuff, and that got snuffed out. And at a lot of places, that doesn't happen. But Augusta's in this weird spot where, if you were, you know, I look at the work that they've been doing, and, you know, it's like some of it, the six holes, one of the big things they did this year, or the second tee. I don't love the work, right? I don't love the idea of the work if I'm looking at it through the lens of we're a great club. You have an Alistair McKenzie course, and some of this work takes it further away from being an Alistair McKenzie course. And if you're looking at it through a club standpoint, I don't like the work. Now, if you're looking at it through a tournament venue standpoint, like moving the tee back on two made a big difference in two. Adding that little, like, back runoff that dips down on six made that shot on six more difficult, and there's more consequence to you when you miss. Is that change on six in the spirit of what Alistair McKenzie wanted and Bobby Jones wanted? No. Like, they don't want to have, like, a little shelf and these sharp edges. It was very artistic, and that sharp edge is very anti-McKenzie, but if you're looking at it through the lenses of a tournament venue and demanding the best out of the pro golfers, you know, maybe that change was good. So I think it's just like, I really believe, you know, more so than maybe in years past, that, listen, this is a tournament venue and golf tournament organization that operates as a club 53 weeks of the year. But, like, the main reason for it is this tournament. And when you look at the changes through that lens, it does make a difference. I will say one parting thing. The changes are one thing. The work is sloppy. And I don't think it's great work that they're been doing, like from the technical, artful nature of the work. It could be done much better. And I would say that's my one big critique.
Well, expand on that a little bit, because when you say it's sloppy, is that going back to what you said about the Alistair McKenzie proto, like layout, if you will, initially? Is that your point on the quote unquote sloppiness?
I just think when you look at this is stuff that a lot of people won't care about. Like the changes are the changes, and I understand that, but it's just like shoddy construction work. You know, there are just the way that the stuff ties in. There's ways that they could tie it into the landscape a little bit better. The way they are utilizing drains, the way, you know, just the way the edges and everything flows together. It doesn't look great. I would compare it to, like, you know, you could get A+ work on your house, or you could go with a cheaper option. And if to me it feels, and I'm not saying they're spending less money. In fact, I bet they're spending more money, but they're just getting less quality work than is out there with other options.
So I wanted to ask you about a couple things, because I think the last 2 years, you talked about changes to the golf course. And I think the big changes to the golf course over the last 3 years have been 13 and 15. And I've seen a couple of articles and podcasts that have talked about how these changes have now made the second nine on Sunday less exciting. And my pushback to that, Andy, and I wanted your thoughts on this, the guy that won the Masters, the best player in the world by an enormous gap, and I'm going to get into that gap in a little bit because it's a point I want to throw your way. That guy hit 13 and 15 and 2 on Sunday when he went on to win. That guy easily hit 13 and 15 and 2. And so if you're pushing those tees back to make it more challenging to hit those shots, the second shots into those par fives, not only does it make it obviously harder to hit the second shot in because you're hitting more club, but it makes those tee shots more demanding. And I know you've been on this on the shotgun start about Max and hitting 3-wood on 13. You have to stand on that tee and hit a really good tee shot, and it's got to move a little bit right to left, probably less than people think on 13, but it does need to move a little bit if you're a long hitter, and Scotty is an extremely long hitter. It's something Colin Morikawa talked a lot about playing alongside the guy, right? He easily hit it on the green in 13 and 15. Easily. I mean, you know, it's not like it wasn't – he didn't need to do it, but he did it because it takes the serious trouble and the big numbers out of play. And so for people out there that say – we've lost some of the roars because of the distance added to 13 and 15. My only pushback at that is the dude that wins the golf tournament, the best golfer on the planet, the guy that's been on this crazy run over the last 25 months, took on those par fives and pulled the golf shots off. And so that's more to me the dudes chasing, the guys that want to win the Masters that haven't won it yet. Colin Morikawa and Max Homa and Ludwig, who's playing in his first Masters. The guys that were close didn't hit those golf shots that the holes are asking in modern times. And if you want to see the guys be able to hit mediocre tee shots and hit 7 irons in, then so you have more eagle putts, that's your distinction on the golf tournament. But to me, what we're seeing in the modern times with these second nine par fives forces the guys to hit awesome tee shots and awesome second shots. And the best player in the world is pulling those shots off.
Yeah, and if you don't hit an awesome tee shot, say you hit a mediocre tee shot, then it just raises the bar on the next shot you have to hit if you want to get home in two, right? What about Tiger when he pulled lumber? Was that on Friday?
On 15 on Friday when nobody was getting there. Everybody was laying up. This dude's 48 years old, and I know he's still got speed, but he took on that golf shot. He probably had a good number, but he took on the shot and hit an awesome shot there. And again, this is what these holes have asked of past generations. You and I have talked a lot about 85 with Curtis Strange over the years when he had hit 3-wood into both those par fives and didn't pull the shots off. But he had to hit 3-wood, and that's a really hard shot with 3-wood. It's not that hard of a shot with an 8-iron.
I think we're in a little bit of an adjustment period. You know, these changes happen, and the holes change a little bit. And what we've gone from is, you know, we used to be like, what a shot, what an eagle. Then we moved to all of a sudden, everybody's hitting these shots. Everybody's got eagle putts. And it's like a little bit like it take away the specialness of getting home in two. And now we're restoring some of that. But there is like a trailing aspect of like, wait, what about all these eagles? You know, I, for one, like, I was lucky to be in the grandstands when Scheffler made his eagle on 13. I'll tell you what, on Saturday, that was a massive moment. I'm not going to forget about that with the way the ball just kind of like crawled up and in over the front edge of the cup. Like, I'll never forget that. The roar from people, because this was like this monumental eagle. After it looked like he was kind of playing himself out of the tournament, he makes this eagle, and then I think he birdied 15 as well. Maybe one other hole coming in, and it's like, oh my God, like this guy, like as soon as you think he's out, he's back in. And I think you look at Scheffler overall, like par five, I think one of the things I took away this year is just how important it is to pick apart the par fives. Scheffler played them 9 under. Everybody since Sergio Garcia has played them at least 8 under par. The golf course and the way they've been able to modernize it has the par threes and the par fours are just so difficult. They just wear on you. Like, there aren't many easy birdies out there. The par fives are where you have to get them. And I think par five performance is just generally, especially with elite players, like a really good barometer of where players are at in their game, because you have to hit good tee shots to score on par fives. You're then hitting long second shots into par five. So if you're hitting great long irons, you're going to have easy two putts, right? But if you're just a little off, then it becomes like, how good's your short game? You're going to have to get up and down to make a lot of birdies on par fives. It's just a really good, I think, all-encompassing stat of like where your game is at. And at Augusta, where you have four reachable, scorable par fives, it is the ultimate barometer. I would love if there was like a side-by-side leaderboard, par five leaderboard, because I bet they would look so, so, so similar.
Well, you brought up the eagle from Scotty on Saturday and how monumental it was, because we hadn't seen a lot of eagles on these holes. I think it was the only eagle on 13 for the day. Basically, what we've replaced with the added distance on those par fives on the second nine is you've got to play the hole effing great to make an eagle. Like, you have to hit three unbelievable golf shots, but you've got to play it really well to make a birdie. And I think that, to me, is the big difference, because one of the things I always felt at the Masters was when we had those guys going out early, like when Rory did it two or three years ago and Spieth did it a few years ago, when he messed up 18 and shot whatever 64, you'd get those guys out early trying to post a number. And in the back of your head, as much fun as it was to watch it, in the back of your head, you thought, well, the leaders still got to play 13 and 15, and they're going to make birdies on those holes.
Yes.
And nowadays, they're not assumed birdies. You know, we saw it with Max on Sunday, where you get to 13 and 15, and if you lay up, you have to hit an awesome wedge shot to make birdie. And those wedge shots weren't awesome. They were fine, and you don't make birdies. And what I like about it is eagles are incredible, but birdies are also really good. And I think that's been something I've enjoyed in terms of the length restoring that feeling, where if you make a birdie on 13, you play that hole awesome, and you didn't have to hit an 8-iron to the middle of the green or a 7-iron to the middle green and 2-putt.
It feels like they've just made those two holes. They've kind of shifted. I'm going to say for 13, it had turned into a par 4.25.
Okay.
And I feel like what they've done now is shifted it back to what they really want it to be, a par 4.5. Like, that's why it's this great hole. It's a you feel frustrated if you don't make a four. But it's still very hard to make a four. And then 15, it feels like it had shifted to like maybe a 4.5. And now it's back to like a 4.75. Right, like 15, especially they got that west wind a couple days. When that thing's barreling into your face, that's about as hard of a par five as you could get, because you know that grit when you're hitting a wedge in, the green's so shallow and you got the wind in front in your face, it's so easy. Like, you know, the first half of the green, you're just not hitting anything on this shallow ass green. You're not hitting anything that lands on the front half, because you know that's gonna spin off into the water. So you, it just gives you this back part. I remember the one. I can't remember which wedge. It might have been right out of the gates on Friday morning. Tiger hit a wedge, and he hit it to like the back edge, and it was howling in. It was cold. He hit it to like the back edge, and he looked so content with where it ended up. Like he was so content missing the green with a wedge. And right. I thought that was like that hole is just everything you could want when it's into a strong wind.
Well, and I mean, you know, everybody's talked about it, Andy, for so long about 15 is, you know, if you lay up, it's one of the hardest wedges in pro golf. And I think what we've seen with the additions at 15 and 13 is you're seeing so many more players have to hit one of the hardest shots in golf. And that should be fun for viewers. It should be fun for fans watching is seeing the best in the world have to manipulate an 80-yard shot. They've got to land on a, you know, 6x6 square to be able to make a birdie. Like, that's the great stuff about this golf course. And it's like Hideki's shot at 15 when he won felt yeah. like an outlier at the time. Now it feels like a bailout we see more often. So I just, that was something I wanted to bring up to you was I thought there was some people that were not disgusted, but frustrated by the fact that we don't see as many eagle roars and cheers and things like that. And to me, it's just simply been replaced by a birdie cheer. And if you do make an eagle, that's incredible. And I will give you another thing I love about this golf course, Andy, because when you're doing featured groups, obviously you're starting everybody out on one. One of my favorite things about Augusta National, my favorite parts of covering this golf tournament, is the first hole is one of the hardest first holes in golf. Played a little easier this year. You saw a little bit more action there. But what I love about it, Andy, I know you've played a lot of tournament golf, is having scoreable holes early in the round is such a mental hurdle. And I love the fact that you get through one and have literally the two most scoreable holes you're likely going to play for the week, especially this year. Two was very easy, and three was relatively easy, depending on the hole location, right? But you feel like you absolutely have to start out 4-4-3 or 5-4-3 or 4-4-4 or something like that, because you know how difficult 4-7 is. And I just think that's so cool to throw the curveball at those players right out of the gate where, you know, I'm settling in the round. I just played the first hole, which is really hard, but I've got to be one under through three, or it's probably going to be a rough first nine. That's such a fun part of Augusta National.
Yeah. And if you think about, if you flip the flip the nines where you'd hit the scoreable stretch on the back nine. If the second nine became the first nine, you'd hit the scoreable stretch. It's your fourth hole would right. be 13. That's such a more comfortable place.
Yeah, you're into it. Even if you're one over, you know, let's yeah. say 10, because that was the way you used to play, right, Andy? It was yeah. initially designed where 10 was the first hole.
Yeah, like 10, 11, 12, if I get through there one or two over, I'm okay. I'm like,
you're
you know
fine.
What? Like, that's fine. I averted the disaster. From there, if you change like the dynamic, it's like getting that first three holes. It's kind of getting out of the blocks, right?
Right.
You could get slow out of the blocks with those three holes and be just fine. You don't feel like you could be slow out of the blocks there with one, two, and three as it exists today.
Correct.
Because you get through with three, and if you're over par, you're like, oh no,
I got no chance. You've got no chance. I mean, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and you mentioned six playing so tough this year. It was firm. Those hole locations are so hard to get to.
Three back hole locations. Like
that is such a stretch of golf. And like, I was a member at Phoenix Country Club, and I used to live in Arizona. And the first hole's the easiest hole in the golf course. It's like 520 par 5 straight away, which would be, if it was in the middle of your round, you're kind of riding down birdie, right? I'm going to make birdie. It's not a big deal. But the fact that it's the first hole, when you don't make birdie on one or eagle at one and you get to two and three, you feel like you left a shot out there to start your day. And I just think since golf is such a middle game, it's such a cool, underrated part of Augusta National is the way the first three holes can either jumpstart your round or can almost ruin your round as you get set for the hardest stretch of the golf course.
Yeah, I think that's a great assessment, observation of Augusta. All right, let's take a quick break and talk about another partner of ours, Oars and Alps. It was refreshing in Augusta National to see the sun as often as we did. It was very warm on the weekend. It was very sunny all week. I mean, it was that type of day, no clouds for like three straight days, which was awesome for watching golf. You could see the ball. You know what? It was one thing, though, with all that sun that I had to worry about was my skin and protecting it. So skin cancer rates have risen 55% among men for the past decade. And the way I protected against that was with Oars and Alps. They make an awesome, easy sunscreen. I've got a couple different sizes. Brendan brought the small size to the golf course. And in my golf bag, I keep a bigger one because I use it so often. So with skin cancer going up, only 14% of men wear sunscreen daily. This is a great way to reduce your chance of melanoma. And golfers are way more likely to develop skin cancers. So one of the reasons I love Oars and Alps products is that they are really good. They have great quality products, but they also don't make you smell when you put the sunscreen on. It's just like putting on your moisturizer. You don't get greasy hands. There's no residue, and it's just simple, easy to use. So I love the different sunscreens. I also love their face moisturizer, the Everyday Anti-Aging Face Moisturizer. It's got the SPF 37 in it. So this is a really easy way to get that SPF on your face every day. Also, for kids, let me tell you, the Go Clear Stick is as easy as it gets. Nobody likes putting sunscreen on their kids. This is a really easy way to throw it to get it on your kids. You know, it doesn't melt in the heat. You keep it in the golf bag, keep it in the pool bag, depending on what you're doing for the kids. So if you're interested in these products, they're really good products. Go to Oars, O-A-R-S, and A-N-D, Alps, ALPS.com/RideEgg. You get 15% off your order with the promo code EGG15.
Andy, can I throw something at you here? I wanted to throw this at you and get your thoughts on it. I think you're probably going to disagree, which is fine with me. But I was thinking about Scotty and the comps that we've had over the last, 3 months and then really over the last year and a half, 2 years. I was thinking about the guys that you and I would list and name as the other superstars in golf. And I think if you and I were going to do this right now, you'd mention Rory and you'd mention Brooks. And you'd mention JT, Morikawa, DJ, that group, right? All of those players, I would say, are in either the second or third phases of their career. Maybe Morikawa's not.
DJ might be in the last.
Yeah, it's fine. DJ's on 17. Like, I think he's just good to be, whatever.
He's on his boat.
His mind's fishing and his body's swinging, right? Like, that's where we're at with this guy. But I was thinking about the gap from Scotty to the next best peer of his. When I say peer, I mean guy in his realm, right? So that's not Rory. That's not Brooks. That's not Jordan. That's not Justin.
It's got to be Morikawa.
Maybe it's Morikawa. And the gap from Scotty to the next best person currently in professional golf feels like a bigger gap than Tiger to anybody of his era when he was in his prime. And I think a lot of that is the players that were in Tiger's era. Vijay wins 9 times in Tiger's
prime.
What about
Rahm? I think Rahm you could throw in the bucket of contemporary.
Okay, that's fine. And maybe Rahm is the guy, and Rahm is similar age to him, and his career is similar. But I was wondering your thoughts on the gap from Scotty to the next best guy. Currently, I'm talking about right now, 2024, mid-April, post-Masters, headed into the rest of major season. The gap between Scotty and the next best player versus at any point in Tiger's career and the next best player. And that next best player was three names, right? At one point, it was Vijay. At one point, it was Ernie. At one point, it was Phil, right? But I'm just wondering, is that a crazy thing to say?
I think right now, I need a little bit more time. Because at this time last year, at the end of the FedEx Cup last year, we were operating in a world where Rahm and Scheffler were equals, and Rahm goes to live, Scheffler takes off this year, and I need a little bit bigger sample size to get there. That being said, if John Rahm finishes 25th in every major the rest of the year, and Scheffler wins two and contends in another one, I'd probably be getting close to that. I mean, now he's got three wins of the year. What do you think for Scheffler over under on, like, if I said 5.5 wins on the PGA Tour? I mean, nobody's winning. 5 wins on the PGA Tour now is like crazy.
Yeah, it's like the
especially
old days.
Because, yeah. You know, like, Scheffler doesn't play many fields that are weak.
If at all. I mean, he plays Houston.
He'll probably play the Dallas events.
Yeah. One of those events. I think that's an amazing over-under. I was thinking 5 as you were talking. Feels like 5 wins is where he should be at by the end of this year if he continues to play even close to what he's been playing. I mean, I think that he played his B-minus to C-plus game in Houston and almost won, right? Again, not the biggest field in the world, but, you know, Tiger beat not great fields in his era at times.
Oh, yeah.
I would say for me to really exclamation mark this point of mine, he's probably got to win 5 times at another major this year is probably the feeling I'd sit in.
Yeah, I think, like, to exclamation point it, if he gets to something like 7 wins this year, which I don't think is crazy.
I don't think it's crazy, but it's so many.
It's so many.
It's more than double what he's won at this point.
6-7 wins. If he gets to something like that, I'm really on board with the, like, there's this huge gap. I think, like, the other aspect of this is he's doing it in an era that's extraordinarily hard to separate yourself. The way that equipment is, you know, it's great for recreational golfers. It's great for people that want to get better at the game. I think for professional golf, it's like muddied the water. Like, he's a great driver of the golf ball and a great long iron player. He rarely hits long irons on the PGA Tour. Like, I think one of the things about Augusta was he was hitting long irons, and that's only going to separate his advantage. It's going to make the advantage bigger.
Yeah. It'd be like if the NBA was like, you know what, Steph's shooting too many threes, let's make the line longer. And you'd be like, well, yeah, that helps Steph Curry. That doesn't do anything to anybody else.
Yeah, and I think, like, if we're talking about Scotty here, one of my big takeaways from the week is Scotty Scheffler's just process. And I think it's so simple. And golf, it's all these counterintuitive things. But when I think about Scotty Scheffler's process, the way he prepares, the way he treats his range sessions, it makes so much sense, and it's so simple, and it's like, well, why doesn't everybody do this? So this was from his pre-tournament press conference. I think Luke Kerdenine asked this question. When you're on the range using that molded grip and you got your practice station sort of all set up, I'm wondering, what exactly are you doing there? And why is that such an important part of your kind of pre-tournament prep? Here's Scotty. Really just checking my fundamentals. I feel like when my swing gets off, it's usually something very basic about what I'm doing. And so I have my grip club because I'm checking my grip. I have my alignment sticks down because I want my alignment to be good. And then and then also helps me with my ball position. Then usually Randy or Teddy is back there making sure I'm taking the club back online. And I'm just working on my form and hitting shots. It's pretty much my normal practice routine. That's exactly how I practice at home. So when I come to a tournament, it just makes is more of the same. So he then goes on to talk about, like, he doesn't have a lot of structure. He just wants to make sure he feels right. Like, he doesn't spend more than an hour out there, and he doesn't make any rash decisions, really, right? So I have long contended, a belief of mine is that if you simply, like, the hardest thing in golf, the actual hardest aspect of playing high level golf is consistently setting up to the golf ball correctly. This is like the most underrated hard thing to do in golf. Everybody talks about like swing plane, all these things. Guess what? If you set up well all the time, there's very little like that can go wrong. And I think like everybody's missing this boat, like the boat of like what Scotty's doing in terms of like, you know, these tour pros, they have their TrackMans out. It's like this, like, don't worry about setting up all your numbers, you know? And all Scotty's doing is like, hey, am I gripping the club right? Is my alignment good? Is the ball position good? Is my takeaway good? And if all those things are good, it is extraordinarily hard to hit a bad shot for a player of their caliber, of a tour pro's caliber. And I just like, maybe golf instruction's gotten too complicated, because this makes so much sense to me. I just like couldn't stop thinking about it once he said this, because it's like, okay, like if you take away like my setup's gonna vary, like I think this, and you probably could attest, like, I find like why I play bad because I play so sporadically is like, oh, like I spent all day, I was aimed like 10 yards left all day and I didn't know it, you know? And that's why I was hitting like pulls and blocks, you know, because I was trying to like fade it back, or I was, you know, my body knew I was in a bad spot. But if you're in set up right, it's almost impossible to hit a bad shot.
I mean, it's what I battle the most, Andy. I mean, literally the thing I battle the most is simply alignment. When I'm not playing a lot of golf, to your point, I'm almost always closed. I see a video of myself and I'm saying, oh, well, of course I hit it bad. My feet are aimed, you know, at 10 o'clock, you know, as a lefty. I mean, I can't do that. It's funny, you know, you saying all of that about Scotty, all I could think about as you were saying that, Andy, was how many things we've talked about and you guys have podcasted about this year of his contemporaries that have changed caddies and changed swing coaches and gone through this and gone through that. Guys like Victor Hovland and Colin Morikawa and even Rory at times, who have kind of, they're dabbling with this person and they're asking questions here, which I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But when you're looking at the guy that's the most consistent player in the world and the best player in the world, all of those things are stable. The instructor's stable, his caddy's stable, what he's trying to work on is stable. He's not trying to go find all these answers that he doesn't need, that all these answers to questions that he doesn't need to ask himself, because he knows if X, Y, and Z work, then my golf swing's going to work. And I just mentioned Steph Curry. I hate to go back to him again, but I remember Steph was on the Smartless podcast a few months ago, and one of the guys asked him a question, like a very simple question about shooting. Said, you know, like, how do you shoot as well as you shoot? And he said, I've gotten to a point in my career where if my feet are set and I'm in balance, I feel like I'm going to make a three. Now, again, Steph Curry never looks like he's in balance. It never looks like his feet are set, right? He's coming off screens. He's shooting crazy shots. But to him, if you break it down to balance, Steph Curry feels like if he's in balance, he's going to make a three-pointer. And for Scottie Scheffler, he feels like if my hands are on the club the right way and my feet are set up the way I want to set them up, I'm going to make a great golf swing. Like, it's simplifying the complicated, which is what pro golfers are almost going against right now.
Think about how easy it is for your grip, for your left hand to maybe shift a centimeter one way, and how massive of an impact that has on everything that goes into the swing and face position of a club. I mean, it's crazy to me, like, as I think about my own golf game, why don't I use a grip club?
Like, I agree with you.
Since Sunday, that's all I've been thinking about is, like, why don't I just, like, I could spend 10 minutes just setting up to a golf ball and not even hitting a golf ball, and I would be better for it. Like, it is so insanely simple that it makes a ton of sense. I had a friend of mine texted me. He's like, isn't the comp, and it's John Ezekowitz, I want to give him credit here, very smart guy, worked in basketball, now does very high level financial things. But John texted me on Sunday, he's like, isn't the comp for Scotty Tim Duncan, the big fundamental? Like, he's boring, doesn't like give you a lot in interviews. I think boring's like, I think he's fairly interesting. I'm not going to say he's not exciting to really super exciting to watch. He doesn't jump off the page on press conferences, but damn, is he good at everything, and he doesn't make mistakes.
That's the best. That's the comp is like a Tim Duncan type mixed with Tiger as a golfer, because to me, he plays golf like Tiger used to play golf. And I think that's probably the biggest compliment you can give anybody in this sport is he's so smart. He's so dialed. He can hit his numbers. He can hit his spots. And that's what Tiger was so good at. And I do want to throw something else at you about Scotty, because I was thinking about the gap that I mentioned to you, and I was watching on Sunday and I was thinking, is Ludwig the guy that we're going to see? Because the biggest bummer about Rom going to LIV for golf fans was last year we kind of had Scotty versus Rom, especially yeah. early in the season. Then we lost that this year. We're going to get him in the majors, which is the golf tournaments that matter, obviously. But I think the buildup at other events helps the majors storylines and leading into the week. And you can go, you know, we had Scotty and Rom go at it at RIV and go at it here and at Bay Hill, yada, 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 right? And we lost that. I wonder if Ludwig's the guy that Scotty's going to battle with over the next 5 years, because it sure seems like talent, length, maturity. I mean, his ability to just act like he's 40 when he's 24 is incredible, and how he doesn't get up and down.
His disposition is on insane. The golf course is really unbelievable for such a young player.
But Andy, don't you feel like they have similar dispositions? Don't you feel yes. like when you watch Scotty, you see a lot of Ludwig in him, where it's just like, all right, man, if I hit it over there, I'll just go find it, try to make par.
I think the other thing is just the golf swing. I mean, it's so simple. I don't see how it can go really wrong ever.
Right, right. I agree with you. So I've been thinking we've lost Rom and Scotty. Like, major championship golf is the only bummer about major championship golf is we only get it 4 times a year. And when you look back over the history of golf, as many duel in the suns as we got, and as many Tiger Phil paired together on Saturday and Sunday at the Masters as we got, more often than not, we never got those, right? Like, we don't get the matchups in professional golf. And this is what the signature events were supposed to be. And unfortunately, I think the signature events have fallen a bit flat after year one, right? They're just not necessarily working. So we need them in majors.
You're not up for Harbortown this week.
It's no knock to Harbortown. It's no knock to anything. It's just simply put, you can't have an NFC championship game and expect people to care the week after the Super Bowl. You know,
you know what this is? You know what it is? It's the Pro Bowl. We just played the Super Bowl, and it's like, oh, we got this Pro Bowl day.
But if you expected the players to play full out, all out at the Pro Bowl, you know, versus it being this silly event. That's what I'm saying, is it's almost like going back to the NFC championship game the week after the Super Bowl, right? Where you go, like, could you imagine asking Patrick Mahomes to go play the best football of his life 4 days after the Super Bowl? That's not a real realistic thing to throw somebody's way. I mean, they're going to change this. I really hope so, because having events after the majors anyway is a bit silly, but having a signature event seems crazy. That's neither here nor there. My point is, we will be lucky if we get Scheffler versus Rahm 1 out of 8 majors over the next 3 years. We'll be lucky if we get that. But if we get Scheffler, Ludwig, and then we get Ludwig Rahm, and then we get Scheffler Rahm, like, there's potential for that. And I feel like there's an opportunity for us to create a little bit of back and forth with Ludwig because he's on the PGA Tour versus Rahm not being there anymore.
Yeah, I mean, listen, like, when the chips were down on Sunday, to me, you know, of the chasers, Morikawa and Max were not, I don't think like exposed is the right word, but I think they were, it was kind of clear that they were in a little bit different situation than Ludwig and Scotty. And I thought Ludwig was like, I wasn't sure about, like, I thought his approach play was a little bit, you know, of a worry coming in. His short game hasn't been the best. But I'll tell you what, like, when you watch him hit the golf shots, I came away like, wow, like, this is a guy that's young that could be in the same mold. Like, Scheffler has no holes. Like, short putting is like the one thing that you can be like, you know what? It's not great. Everything else is just like, well, he could be the best at that. Like one of the things, like Scheffler's not going to lead strokes gained off the tee. But from a sense of, I don't know of any big hitter that has a better fairway finder than Scheffler. Like if you tell me like, oh, I need a guy that to hit it 300 in the fairway, like Scotty's my, like he tees the ball down and he hits that little bleed cut and it's just like, okay. And then when you pair that with his iron play, it's unstoppable. It's impossible because that stuff shows up week in, week out. Ludwig feels similar where you could get to a point where it's like, cause like the short game stuff, this is just technique. Like that's easy, super easy to get better at short game. I think like you could get to above average with just technique. I think Scotty's generational with short game because it's like what he grew up doing. There's that famous stuff with like the Royal Oaks. It was, you know, the pros were out there and, you know, short game was the only place he could beat them. You know, like that's the stuff, like the generational short game players, whether it's Seve or whether it's Phil or whether it's, you know, now Scotty and like Cam Smith to me is another one that like, I love watching them. Like they just have something that even great technical short game players don't have. And it's this thing that like imagination mixed with perfect technique. But I could see Ludwig getting to a level of golf where he is really sound at everything and great. Like, you know, when you look at Ludwig versus Scotty off the tee, like that's where Ludwig can really do some things that Scotty can't do, you know?
Yeah, you mentioned I think this is worthy to mention because we talk so much about Scotty and now we're talking a lot about Scotty and that's followed by Tiger. Is Tiger wasn't a great driver of the golf ball. He hit a lot of distance in his day, but he wasn't a great driver of the golf ball. He hit it wayward even in his prime. Jack wasn't a great chipper of the golf ball, right? I mean, there were slight holes in the greats' games. And so for Scotty's hole to be 5 feet and in or whatever the case may be, whatever you want to call it, everybody that's been great has had a little bit of a hole in something, right? So this isn't different for Scotty than it is for...
unconquerable game.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, I just wanted to point that out. And I think you're spot on. The chipping, the pitching, the sand play, the shots that he can hit with his wedges are absolutely next level. Now, my next point I wanted to throw at you, Andy. This isn't red meat for you, dude. I'm not doing this to get you riled up or to make you jump on a perch that you've sat on for a while. Is it realistic to say that the Spieth JT era is, or we're past it? Is that realistic to say?
It's a great question. I think when you think about stars, you have to think about their windows. And I think like, to me, the question is the really, really great players are 10-year windows generally.
Right. You've been on this forever and it's great. I love when you do this, by the way.
Tiger's like 10 years to the T. Like 97 to 2006. Just like, and it's a different career after that. You know, Phil is an outlier where he's kind of spanned out. Nick Faldo, if you look at it, 10 years. Then there's other guys like David Duval, 5 years.
So those guys are the good, those are the good, not great, right? Those are the guys that were very good, but maybe not generationally great. I mean, David Duval won one major championship, won a Players, but again, not to the level of the guys you mentioned.
So you just, I think like looking at it through the context of years, and it's very rare, it's extraordinarily rare to get a 20-year star like Phil, like Rory is trending towards. Like Rory is trending towards somebody that seems like he's going to be effectively a top 15 player in the world for 20 straight years. That is extremely rare. So if you think about it through that context, like JT and Spieth have had 5 great years. And in Spieth's stamp for Spieth, like when was his last great year? 2018?
It's a long time ago. I mean, that's 6 years ago.
And you think about it, it's like, okay, like he had 5 great years. And now we're at 10 years. We're almost at, I think, about 10 years of Jordan Spieth. And it's okay, like, if he's not the same player. I think, like, the game has changed a lot. That off the tee, like, the game has changed tremendously since Spieth came. But also, like, the fabric of Spieth. One thing I've been thinking about a ton is just, like, how golfers' mindsets change when they're 21 versus when they're 31.
Right.
Just the idea of, like, who you are. When you, I noticed this, like, I was on a hike in Sedona, and I was just, like, I was kind of nervous about, like, where I was. And the heights. And I was a kid that was like scared of nothing. But it was just like this idea. And it kind of like clicked with me. Is like you get older and things change in your mind. The way you approach life. The way you think about life. The way you think about golf. Some people get better. Some people get worse. But I think with regards to a lot of the players that are aging. They're in aging. I mean, like at this point, it's like they're into their 30s. The relationship that themselves have with golf has changed significantly. And I think that that is a piece that's immeasurable in terms of there's no analytics, there's no strokes gain number, but like the what they're thinking about when they're standing over a shot or what they used to never think about and now they do think about. That has definitely changed for all of these guys.
Yeah, I feel like with those two guys, I was thinking about Jordan and Justin because we talk about them at every major in some capacity, right? We talk about Jordan the most, and then we talk about Justin as well. Is they have to play absolutely perfect golf these days to win golf tournaments. And I'd say they almost have to play beyond perfect golf to win a major championship. I mean, JT, listen, he played great at the PGA Championship. He won. I'm not taking anything away from him. He shot 67 in the final round, needed a little bit of help by a couple guys, and he won the PGA. He was there, and he won it. And that's a major, and that's a big deal. But this is a guy that has missed four of his last five cuts in major championships, and he's won once in 2021. Now, that's a player's that he won, by the way. Played great. Shot 64 on Saturday, near flawless golf. And he won once in 2022, and that was the PGA Championship. These are enormous wins from Justin Thomas. But when you talk about when were they last great, I think Jordan, you go back to 2018, and I think for Justin, you go back to 2017. Like this is a lengthy gap between them being really monumentally great and in the conversation at multiple big events and then playing well for a week and winning and then kind of going away. And so I've been really thinking about the era we're in right now. And it feels like this year more than ever, we have turned the page on a lot of the guys that you and I have covered for decade plus.
Yeah. I think they still have the talent and the skills to knock one of these off.
Totally agree.
But to think of them as first page favorites is a bit silly at this point.
It's hard to put them in that. And it's hard to put those guys with where their games are and where they're, this isn't recency. This isn't recently they've been playing bad golf. I mean, this is now on years, right? For both of these guys. I mean, the way they've played in the Ryder Cup and the way they've played when they've teamed up in these events, like we laugh at this stuff, Andy, we joke with how they perform as a team. Because at one point in their prime, that team was unbeatable. That team had two guys that were top five talents in the world that had the game and the ability, and to your point, the mindset, to go out there and flush it and beat the hell out of anybody that stood in front of them. And they simply can't do that anymore on skill set alone. They've either got to find something that is absolutely clicking a bull for 4 days, or they've got to run into somebody that does something silly like Mito did or plays terrible in a match for them to win. And I just wonder, to your point about odds and first page and things like that, is are we flipping the page on that crew and who is that next top five page? Is it Ludvig and Scotty and Rom and whom else?
I was going to ask you, like, if I gave you Zalatoris and Cam Young versus Spieth and JT, the rest of the majors, who are you taking?
I mean, Zalatoris and Cam Young, no doubt about it. I mean, I'd take Tom Kim as well. Like, I mean, I'd take these younger guys that are extremely hungry right now over, as I mentioned, Justin Thomas, who has missed four of his last five cuts in major championships, and Jordan Spieth, who in that first round looked like a guy that had absolutely no idea what window the ball was going to come out of, had no idea what shot was going to come out of the face, if it was going to go left or right. You know, it's not close. This isn't shooting 74, 73 and missing the cut. This is shooting nearly 80 on the same day that Bryson shoots 65. I mean, you're talking, what's that, 14 shot difference? I mean, you know, that was the scorable day, Andy, is and Jordan goes out and shoots, whatever, 79.
Well, I mean, like, he's an Augusta National specialist is his reputation, but, you know, that was based off of his first five Masters, where he went T2, win, T2, T11, third. You know, if you go from 2019...
6 years ago? 7 years ago? Is that the last time? Like, yeah, what are we talking about? 2017? 2016?
2018 to the end. And now 2019 on, T21, T46, T3, cut, T4, cut. So, like, still some, you know, this is a great golf course for him to pop up and play well at, but it's a different player. And I think, like, one of the other things with majors is, like, and what enthuses you about Scotty has to, is the most challenging major mentally to win, and the one that can kind of haunt you. The Masters, he's now knocked off to very early, and he's with the list of two-time Masters champions is like pretty good. You know, like, I think the one player you could probably look at on that list and say is Bubba Watson, but that being said, like, still, it's such an impressive list of players.
Winning multiple Masters and going back to the Jordan thing, right? The way Jordan started his career at Augusta National, we all said he was going to win multiple green jackets. And I would now be surprised if Jordan Spieth wins another Masters. I mean, the game's getting better and better by the second. Guys are getting longer and longer. They're coming out earlier. They're hitting it straighter as well. I mean, it's going to be tougher for him to win each and every year as we move forward. I feel the same way about Rory. Obviously, Rory is a completely different player in terms of skill set than Jordan Spieth is, but it's not getting easier for Rory to do it. Really, Sergio's the outlier in terms of a guy that's won in this many starts at Augusta National, right?
I think, like, one of the things, the rollback's slated for 2029.
Yep.
Could there be a potential, like, where we have 2029 come around and then all of a sudden, like, long irons are hit more and short game matters more again. And we have, like, this era that then there's, like, a correction. Cause when you put regulations in, there are, like, unintended consequences that'll happen. And right, it could push us back to where, like, some of the older players that are used to playing golf when the ball doesn't go a mile, are actually, you know, rewarded. And I think that is one thing to think about with Spieth.
Okay.
Is that if the game is scaled back a little, I think he is, you know, really going to be bumped up. I think, like, what's funny to me, like, what's actually, like, comical to me with all the rollback talk is, like, a lot of the players who would benefit the most from a rollback are vociferous against it. You know, like, you know, Justin Thomas is a great example. Like, when he came on tour, he was like, he was an elite driver of the ball because of the distance. Like, he had pop in the bat that other people didn't have. Now you go down to driving range and it's like Justin Thomas kind of just another guy on the range. But
just another guy for you. You're going to have to make new hats.
But, like, you watch Justin Thomas around the greens, you watch him hit long irons, you watch him move the ball, and you're like, wow, this guy is something. Those skills have all been kind of diluted as players have gotten longer and longer, and fewer and fewer courses are able to hold up to it.
All right, so we're talking a lot about Scotty, and every pod that's doing anything post-Masters is talking pretty much exclusively about Scotty Scheffler, right? if you and I had done this podcast at the end of 2014, you and I would be talking about Rory and what's the future and how many majors is he going to win. So let me ask you this, Andy. How is this different than Rory in 2014, where he'd won three straight, including two majors, and he was king of golf, and he was going to win 10 majors, and now we're sitting here still waiting for the next one? How is Scotty's run right now different than Rory in 2014, Jordan in 2015, JT in 2017, where he wins five times in a major championship? Why do you feel like this might feel different, if it feels different to you at all? And how does Scotty not, in theory, fall off a major cliff in the next 6 months or 2 years and never win another major again?
Well, the beauty of sports, the beauty of covering this, is we have no clue.
But it
feels
different.
It might be the same. It feels different, but in the moment, it's always hard to, you know, you always tend to over inflate things.
Yeah.
I think, like, to me, like, the approach of Scotty, of the fundamental stuff that I talked about, he doesn't seem to me to be a guy like we've seen with Spieth. Like, Spieth's on top of the golf world and he's trying to change his golf swing. You know, like, that should always be mentioned. Like, you know, where he is now, the game got harder for him because he tried to make a big change. I read something about Victor Hovland changing his golf swing over the last, you know, 6 months, since he was playing the best golf of his life. And it's
he wanted to change it. He wanted to change it during the playoffs. He was unhappy with the way he was swinging. When he shot 28 on the back at the BMW or whatever, and then wins the tour championship, he was talking about wanting to change things.
I mean, I think Rory's swing has changed dramatically from 2014. You know, it's not the same. He's got different equipment. Like, there's all these things that go into it. I think one of the other difficult things when you become a superstar, a super duper star, is the time commitment of all the other stuff. And the clutter, really. Like, if you are the best golfer on the planet for a couple years running, you're going to have more time commitments. And it goes to, like, you know, I think, like, a thing is, if you want to be truly great at anything, you have to put the time in and you have to continue to block out the time to do the stuff that you're great at. It's, I think, why you see so many bands be one hit wonders, like one album wonders. You get famous and then you stop putting in the work that made you famous. And with golfers, I think it's the same thing. Like, you become great and then you get all these, like, burdens. Like, I'd love to hear Ricky Fowler sometime talk about what, you know, his life looked like when he was peak endorsements. Yeah. And how that took a toll on his golf game. But I think that's the thing with Scotty, is like, can he keep his life simple? And I think like, if you want to make a case for him being different, that's the thing I think I have a lot of faith in him not changing.
Andy, I've never thought about this, and I'm asking you this question kind of blindly, but it's an incredibly good point about Scottie Scheffler. But now that I'm thinking about it, so Scottie wears Nike with no other branding on him, right? He doesn't have branding on the golf bag, I don't think.
It's TaylorMade.
I think Jonathan Wall said that the leaderboard now, like, you know, Titleist will put their mark next to players that play a Titleist ball or a Titleist ambassador ball player. That was not on the Masters leaderboard. So maybe he's moved away from that partnership. But I'm trying to think of brands that Scotty's aligned with away from those two companies, TaylorMade and Nike. I don't know if there is one. Is that crazy?
He's got
to
that fitness company that you see the cover. You know, what is it, Forever Golf or whatever?
Well, all I'm saying is, like, in an era of marketing across the vest and on the sleeve and on the back and all of those things, for people that don't know at home, every brand that you're signing on to is going to ask stuff out of you, whether that be a corporate day,
maybe it's 3 days, 4 days, like
something like that. But that stuff adds up. And all of a sudden, if you've got five sponsors on your shirt, that's 15 or 20 days of your year. If Scotty eliminates that entirely to just be this normal dude in Texas, how amazing is that for your mental health and your mental approach?
It's a competitive advantage.
Huge advantage.
I from what I gather, Nike hasn't used any of its player days in years. So the Nike deal has days, but they don't use them. So you have like all this only person that asks him for time is TaylorMade.
I mean, that's that like he, again. So he's gaining. Let's say against the anybody else in the top 10 in the world. Let's just say, and again, you and I don't know this for sure. So if this is slightly wrong or wrong, that's on us. But I'm going to assume that the best golfer in the world gains 15 free days over anybody else in the top 10 in the world. And I think that's probably fair to say.
Yeah. I mean, and think about even if you just spent the 15 days at home with your family doing nothing, how big of an advantage that is over going, flying somewhere to do a corporate thing.
So same instructor since he was a kid, same community and great family, wife that he's been with, I think maybe since high school or college or whatever the case may be, right? He's not trying to kind of push himself out to different brands to make more money because he understands that if he plays great golf, he will make the money that in theory he would have made from the brands. And I mean, I can only imagine brands are calling his agent all the time, right? I mean, this is the number one golfer in the world that's getting people to come his way. So you're doing all of these things to make your life as simple as possible. And I would say on top of that, and I know this was a big talking point Masters Week, but this is a dude that has constantly said golf does not define me. So if he doesn't win another major championship, I would say if you look at Scottie Scheffler, he seems like a dude that would be completely content in that world. Man, I won two Masters. What a great life I've led. And now I know he's competitive, and I know he talked on Sunday about telling his buddies on Sunday morning, I wish I didn't like winning this much. But that's what he does. That's who he is as a professional golfer, as an athlete, as a person that's job is to be a golfer. But stepping away from that world to not be burdened by all these other things has got to be unbelievably freeing to this guy.
Yeah. I mean, it's the simplicity. The simplicity is what makes you believe that this is sustainable.
Amazing. Just amazing.
All right, Shane, it's been a pleasure. Do you have any other loose ends that you want to tie?
Dude, I have absolutely no idea if we talked about anything or if we talked about something. I have no idea. I think we talked about something. Yeah. Anyway.
Do you have anything else you want to unload? Any Bryson takes? Anything else?
I've got a Bryson take. I wrote this on Twitter earlier in the week that I missed him a lot. He is so awesome to watch compete at golf in every way that we to laugh at, to laugh with, to marvel at, to be impressed by, to scratch your head on. Everything the guy does is exactly what we need in our sport. And the fact that we don't get to see him as much as I wish we got to see him is a bummer because, again, either because of him or alongside him, he is an absolute treasure.
I did 36 holes at Bryson in the middle. I did Friday and Saturday with Bryson.
Come on. Did you really?
It was unbelievable.
You're a Bryson stan. There you go. Look at you.
I got to say, like, I think one of the tough things with him is who he was at 23 is what everybody, like, kind of, like, came away with.
Totally.
You know, and built opinions on. But to so many people, who you are at 23 is like so different than who you are at 30. Yep. And I'm not, I don't think he's like, listen, dude, am I going to hang out with Bryson? Would I? Probably not. Like, but I do think like he's gotten more self-awareness. And if he was doing what he's doing with his YouTube page and playing on the PGA Tour, I mean, this guy would be the most talked about player in golf. Like, his YouTube page is like legitimately pretty good. I think it's generating fan interest, like especially young fans. And the thing I saw with Bryson that I loved was he just like engages with the people. He just wants to be loved.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's Saturday and he's in the final group and he's like pounding fists with people. And you know, was he in the second to last group? He was in the second to last group with Max. He's he's engaging with the fans. Like on Friday, there weren't a lot following him, and it was amazing. Like you could hear all the interactions with the fans. Like he's opening up his snack bag, and somebody's asking him what's in it. Like who?
And he's answering them.
And he's answering them.
Okay.
He like nobody else. Like the professional golfers get inside the ropes and they ignore everybody.
Right.
He's actually engaging with people. I mean, his response was great. He's got the bag open. It's a big Ziploc bag. This bro is like, Bryson, what's in the bag, man? And you could tell he was like trying to think of what to say. And he was just like, the good stuff, bro.
I mean, like ridiculous, and you roll your eyes at it, but you also enjoy it. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Also like, it's kind of cute. Like he's kind of a cute guy now, you know, versus what he used to be where he wasn't the most fun human to be around. I'll say this, like you can impact so many people's opinion of you by one simple interaction, especially yeah. young people, right? You think about giving a golf ball to a kid and that kid's forever going to remember that even when they're an adult. I remember when Bryson DeChambeau gave me a golf ball at the Masters. I remember this was before the waste management enclosed 16 all the way around. So there was kind of a walkway between 16, 17. I was in college, okay? I was an idiot. Of course I was an idiot, right? I mean, I'm an idiot now, for God's sakes. You mentioned Bryson at 23. I mean, I was 21 and a complete dipshit. And I was there with some friends of mine, and we were standing on 17T, and there's always a wait on 17, as you know, short par 4. One of my buddies was trying to get guys to bet 20 bucks they drive the green, okay? 20 bucks you don't drive the green as they're standing there. I'll never forget this. Nick Watney came over and was laughing about it and was into it and was like cracking. Oh, I always drive the screen. You don't want to take this bet. You know, like having fun with us, right? And I remember there was another guy a couple groups later that was offended by the question, that came over to us and was kind of getting into my buddy's grill about even asking or bringing up such a horrible thing at a pro golf tournament. And I will never forget Nick Watney's approach to that, and the guy that did it, the B guy that acted the way he acted. And if you're Bryson and you're out at the Masters and you're yucking it up with fans and patrons and you're doing all that stuff, those guys are going to be fans of you for life. And I feel like Bryson, as you said, is a guy that has just wanted to be loved. And it feels like people that he's understanding how to do that. And also he's got the personality that allows that to happen. You know, he's a pretty fun-loving, kind of goofy kid, but I like the Bryson we're seeing right now, and I think he might be the most interesting pro golfer in the world.
Yeah, I found myself fascinated by him. I asked him a question, which I believe is, so I asked him about the YouTube stuff. Like, you know, you talk about like the most regimented, rigid golfer in the world when he was going full steam.
Right. Right.
Since then, he's done this YouTube stuff and he's done like a lot of different stuff. He played one club with Sergio Garcia for 9 holes. And you could see at the beginning of that round, he had no clue what to do. But this is one of the most talented players in the world. They played for 9 holes. And by the end of the 9, you could see he really was starting to learn how to hit the shots. Sergio, like I recommended this on a pod months ago to go watch this. Sergio was incredible. Like, utterly unbelievable to watch play golf with one club because he has all the shots. He has everything. But by the end of the round, Bryson got like a lot better. So he's done like forward tees, break 50.
Right.
He played the old equipment. So he's done all these different weird things. And what I asked him was like, do you think you're a better player because of these YouTube formats you've done? And he's like, oh, definitely. I'm more versatile. Like I'm not locked into this is the way I play because these other ways has like, you know, I'm paraphrasing what he said, but you know, I have to believe that he's getting better because of this experimentation. He's learning more shots. He's not as locked into like the science of like this swing, this spin, all that, because he's doing things that require you to think differently. And I think like it's a beautiful kind of evolution. Now I wish that the world got to see him play. Instead, they're playing on, you know, a platform that gets, you know, 100,000 viewers instead of 2 million.
Caffeine TV or what?
caffeine.
Gets
I'm not gonna. I'm not gonna acknowledge the caffeine. But like, I think he's a fascinating character. I can't wait to see him again at the PGA. I can't wait for the U.S. Open. I can't. You know, I would love to see. And I think this is a reason why the game has to come back together, is because there are characters like, it's too small of a game to be split and only getting this four weeks a year.
By the way, last thing, he's my pick to win the PGA. Just want to throw that out there. Bryson's my PGA pick. I'm putting it out there right now so that it's on the record. Now, if I pick four other people on podcast and on Twitter, that's on me.
Key. That's the key. on our preview, Masters preview, I pick Scotty.
Okay.
That being said, later in the week, I changed my pick twice.
To who?
So I went to Rahm and then I went to Rory. Because I got to the point where nobody believed Rory was going to win. So I was like, well, you know, it would be a good moment to be on the other side of the fence.
Well, at least you played the hits. At least you didn't go like totally off the board. But yeah, that's interesting. I'm taking Bryson out the PGA. Andy, I love what you guys did throughout the week. It's must listens to Shotgun with you and Poor F. It's very entertaining. I'm glad I got to kind of eat lunch next to you one day. Even though they wouldn't let us push our tables together, but that was great. Even though, you know, no computers at the lunchroom. The Masters week is the best week, and I want to give a shout out to this. Simply this, the Masters social team is. I worked a little bit with them, and it's a group of people that want to put out awesome stuff. Now they do put out awesome stuff, but they want to put out awesome stuff, and I feel like in an era where that's not always the case across a lot of media, not obviously not just golf, but across a lot of media where sometimes it can feel like a job, that team and that crew makes an effort to put out unbelievable, awesome content for a week. And you're left wishing that you got more of it. And that is an extreme compliment in this day and age. So shout out to that crew and that team, because they absolutely crush it.
I mean, they dominate Masters Week. It's hard being creators in this space because they do such an awesome job. Yep. That it's hard to have stuff that stands out because you know you just aren't going to be able to match the quality. You know, part of that's access, but you know the other part is the talent that they've amassed over there.
And the interest to be great. I mean, you got it's like Scotty, you got to want to be great. But anyway, that's it's the best week. I love it. I'm bummed it's over. I hate that we have to go a year till we get it again, but I am happy that we still have some majors. I do feel like, do you think you get more bummed out post-Masters or post-Open?
Post-Open.
Okay, me too. I agree.
I mean, like then it's just like, what are we doing for 8 months?
And you got to start thinking about the Bears too, which is probably cuts kicks
in the
gut. I mean,
this year, we got the draft. There's a lot of optimism. I saw Sauce Gardner tweeting about how did the Bears pull this off? They got tons of talent and two picks in the top 10. I think the NFL is a little worried about my Bears.
There you go. Always a pleasure, right, my friend.
Talk to you soon, Shane. All right, that does it for today's episode of the Friday Golf Podcast. Big thanks to Matt Ruches for throwing this together, editing it all up, and all of his hard work last week. He was doing a lot of those Masters reels that you might have seen on our Instagram. As a quick reminder, you know, Masters is over. It's time to get back into Club TFE. We are going to be grinding. I know Garrett is planning to have a Harbortown profile up, and Design Notebook will be kicking back off this week. So if you're interested in more content from us, I think I'm jumping on next week on a hangout on Club TFE. But if you're interested in more content, just join Club TFE. It's $120 for the entire year. And it goes to support a lot of the stuff we do. And I think you get a lot of great content for it. So join Club TFE. It's thefriedegg.com/membership. And you can sign up there. Thanks for all the support, and thanks for another great Masters week. It's a true privilege to get to cover these events. It's unbelievable to get to go to Augusta National for a week and cover it, and wouldn't be able to do it without all of your guys' support over the years. So big thank you to you guys, and we'll be back next week with another podcast, maybe two podcasts.